Well, I'm looking forward to this night with Jeffrey Bennett. Scientists say they have extraordinary new evidence to support a Big Bang theory for the origin of the universe, and researchers believe they have found the signal left in the sky by the super rapid expansion of space that must have occurred just fractions of a second after everything came into being. It takes the form of a very distinctive twist in the oldest light detectable with telescopes. Amazing. This work scrutinized carefully, but already there's talk of a Nobel Prize here, so you never know. In a moment, Jeffrey Bennett joins us. We'll talk about his latest work, What is Relativity? And then later on tonight, we'll talk about his other work, Beyond UFOs, next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Jeffrey Bennett with us, author of several textbooks dealing with astronomy, mathematics, statistics, astrobiology. Dr. Bennett served a couple years as a visiting senior scientist at NASA headquarters, where he created numerous educational programs for the Hubble Space Telescope and other space science missions. In addition, one of the founders of the Big Kid Science, which is a company dedicated to educating and inspiring children with the wonders of science. He was last with me about 2.5 years ago. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Jeffrey Bennett. Hey, Jeffrey, how are you?
Very good, George. Wonderful to be back again.
Looking forward to this, too. You've been away too long.
It's been a while.
I think we talked about Beyond UFOs when you were on with me a couple of years ago.
We did.
And interesting, you live out in the Boulder area where we tape our television show Beyond Belief. So one day we will come a-knocking, Jeffrey.
Sounds wonderful.
We'll do it. So tell us a little bit about your reaction to this story about this cosmic inflation, this spectacular discovery here.
Well, it's a very, very cool result that they have come up with and helps shed light both on Einstein's general theory of relativity and quantum mechanics and the early universe and how all those things are tied together.
Basically says Einstein was right, doesn't it?
Well, it is again saying Einstein was right, yep. But it also sheds light on the one hole that we know about in relativity.
And what is that?
And that is how you reconcile relativity and quantum mechanics. You have here two different theories, one that deals with the very, very small quantum mechanics and one that deals with the very, very large general relativity. And both have been tested incredibly in great, incredible detail, and both have passed every test given. And yet, when you calculate how they would merge together if you took something really big like the universe and made it really small like it was at the time of the Big Bang, they give somewhat different answers. So we know there has to be a way to reconcile that difference, even though both have passed all the tests. And this is the first sort of piece of evidence that we have that goes back to that time when they had to be together and reconciled.
Jeffrey, title of your book, very poignant, What is Relativity? So let me ask you from the get-go, in your opinion, and try to explain it for us, what is relativity?
Well, in the very broadest terms, relativity is our modern scientific theory of space, time, and gravity. And that means it is our theory that tells us about the whole foundation of the universe, since you don't have a universe without space, time, and gravity.
When we talk about space and time and gravity, gravity, I think, is the variable that probably may be the thing that gets all this done. But during the earlier days, they didn't consider gravity much in the equations, did they?
Gravity was always kind of a thing that was just there. And the first time that we really had a good understanding of gravity was from Newton in the 1600s when he came up with his law of gravity, which is essentially his theory of gravity and how it works. And it works, Newton's theory was really remarkable because it works extremely well, right? We can send spacecraft to the planets with really nothing more than Newton's theory of gravity to guide us. But Newton himself recognized that there was something sort of odd about gravity, namely that it attracted bodies at a distance. Gravity keeps Earth orbiting the sun, and yet the Earth is 93 million miles away from the sun. How is it that Earth knows the sun is there to be able to respond to its gravity? And Einstein's general theory of relativity fills in that gap. It explains what's actually going on in the universe that makes it possible for Earth to know the sun is there.
What a great mastermind to put all this together, Jeffrey. I mean,
it was really a remarkable accomplishment when Einstein did general relativity in particular. So I should note that he published the theory of relativity. I'm saying it is like one theory, but it was actually published in two parts, and you'll often hear people talk about it as two different things. One is the special theory of relativity that he published in 1905, and the other was the general theory of relativity that he published in 1915. So we're coming up on the 100th anniversary.
Gosh.
Of that. Yep, amazing. It's been 100 years, and yet most people still don't know much about it. And it's our theory of space, time, and gravity, which is why I decided to write this book, so that everybody could get a chance to learn a little bit about what this theory really is. But special relativity, when Einstein did that in 1905, it was a revolutionary theory, but there were a number of other people working in the same direction already, because there were some known problems that had to be worked out. At the time that he then moved on towards general relativity, most everybody else kind of thought he'd solved all the problems already, even without accounting for gravity. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between special and general. Special applies to the special case in which we don't worry about gravity. And when he looked to include gravity, you know, most other people weren't looking that direction because they didn't think there was anything else to figure out. And he realized there was still these holes in the whole general understanding, and he plugged them with general relativity and really took us probably a couple decades beyond where we would have been if he hadn't been around.
Was he controversial in his day, Jeffrey?
Well, I would say not really, because when he published his theories, Einstein was a very, very careful scientist. So he did not say, here's what you should believe from me. What he did was he actually went and had the solid evidence behind it. So when he published special relativity in 1905, it solved so many already known problems in physics that it was pretty clear he had to be correct. And the same is really true with general relativity, in that the one problem that some people had recognized already and that everyone recognized in retrospect was a problem with the way Mercury's orbit deviates very, very slightly from what Newton's theory of gravity predicts. And he cleared up that mystery by the time he published the theory in 1915. Then even more importantly, his theory makes this prediction that gravity should bend light in very specific ways. And that was then tested during a total solar eclipse in 1919, so 4 years after he published his theory. And when that prediction was confirmed by two different groups observing the eclipse in two different places around the world, that was when he became famous and became a household name, because every newspaper in the world reported on it, much the way everybody's reporting on this new discovery right now.
He did all this with his mathematics, writing things down, putting them on chalkboards. If he had computers, modern-day computers today, what do you think he'd be able to accomplish?
You know, that's a very, very interesting question. Computers can't do theoretical physics right now. They can help us with the calculations, but they can't help us figure out what the equations should be. So in the case of relativity, it's not clear that computers would have helped him much at all. Of course, we are able to then calculate things much, much faster, so he would have been able to make his predictions quicker. A number of cases along the way with Einstein, sometimes he made mathematical errors, and then it took him extra time because he had to go back and fix them. With computers, he probably wouldn't have had to waste that extra time along the way.
These theories that he came up with, did anybody ever try to challenge them?
They are challenged constantly, and that's really the way science works. If somebody's come up with a great theory and you want to be more famous, the only way to do it is to figure out a better theory. And so people are challenging general relativity in particular all the time, and there have been numerous alternatives that have been proposed over the years. And so far, every time we've gotten to the point where we can test general relativity versus one of the alternatives, general relativity has won. The alternative has not. One of the important things to remember is that in science, if a theory works, it means it's actually explained lots of things that we've observed and tested. And so you can't ever say that theory didn't explain it when it did. What you can do is say, oh, I know a place where the theory will break down. And in a way, that's exactly what happened with Einstein compared to Newton. Newton's theory works great for all the places we fly spacecraft and everything else. Where it begins to break down is when gravity becomes very strong, and that's why it gives a slightly incorrect answer for Mercury's orbit. But still, the answer is almost perfect from Newton's theory. It's off in the very, very slim margins, but relativity gets it exactly right. And then as you go closer to the sun or closer to an even stronger gravitational source like a white dwarf, neutron star, or black hole, Newton's theory starts to give more incorrect answers. Einstein's still holds up. So when people propose alternatives, they're looking, where is it that Einstein's might not be working perfectly and can we test it?
I enjoyed the juxtaposition of talking about what would happen if people took a trip through a black hole. And it kind of explained to us what black holes are, Jeffrey, and then what would happen if we went through one?
Well, what we do and what I do in the book is I take you on a journey to a black hole. We do not know exactly what would happen if you went through one, other than you probably can't because you'll die in the process. But black holes are a very much misunderstood thing for one reason, because they're a somewhat esoteric idea to begin with, a hole in the universe. What do we mean by that? But secondly, unfortunately, a little bit of popular culture, Disney made a movie in 1979 or so called The Black Hole that really threw people off in terms of what's important about them. And the particular thing is, if you ask almost anybody, from little children to adults, what would happen if you passed near a black hole, or if, say, the sun were to turn into a black hole, everyone will typically answer, well, then we'd be sucked in. The Earth would be sucked in. Like a vacuum, right? And remember what I said before, that Newton's theory of gravity works great as long as you're not super close or in super strong gravity. If the sun changed into a black hole, as long as its mass didn't change at our distance of 93 million miles, there'd be no noticeable difference. Earth would continue to orbit exactly the same. Of course, it'd be cold and dark once the sun went out, but the orbit wouldn't change. And if you were flying, even if you were flying quite near a black hole, you would just orbit around it like you would around any other object of the same mass. It's only when you get really, really close to the black hole that you begin to see the effects that Einstein's theory of relativity predicts.
These laws of physics that are throughout the entire universe, do you think there's any kind of deviation anywhere, or are they all the same, these laws?
That is a really interesting question that we don't completely know the answer to. Now, within what we call our observable universe, and that is the universe that we can in principle see with our telescopes. And in sort of basic terms, it means that since the universe is about 14 billion years old, we can see out to a distance of what you would call 14 billion light years. Mm-hmm. You can't see beyond that because, let's say you were looking to someplace 15 billion light years away, well, that light would take 15 billion years to reach us, which means since the universe is only 14 billion years old, it hasn't got here yet. So the observable universe is the part that we can in principle see. Within the observable universe, we've looked in all directions at all kinds of objects, galaxies out to great distances, and they all seem to be behaving quite similarly, which tells us that the laws of nature are the same throughout the observable universe. Now, one of the things that this discovery announced yesterday tells us is that our observable universe is, in fact, only a small part of the entire universe, because this thing called inflation that you've been hearing about in the news shot things out so rapidly and so widely that our observable universe, even though it's enormous, right, it's the whole universe to us, is only a tiny part of all of what must have existed from the Big Bang. And in fact, it could even go beyond that. There could be other universes, what we call the multiverse,
right.
The idea that there's just ours might be just one of many universes. And you run into this great problem, which is that since we cannot observe beyond the observable universe, there's no way for us to check if the laws of nature are the same.
I would think they were, but who knows?
Who knows? And when you hear about the multiverse, one of the ideas behind that is that our observable universe might be only a very small part of what we might call the whole universe, where the same laws of nature would operate. But then there might be these other universes that would have different laws.
We can see back how far before the Big Bang?
We cannot see before the Big Bang at all.
Right.
So the further out we look in space, the further back we look in time. And so the idea is if you look to a star that's 10 light years away, you're seeing light that took 10 years to reach you. If you look to a galaxy that's 7 billion light years away, you're seeing light that took 7 billion years to reach you, which means, since the universe is 14 billion years old, it left when the universe was half its current age.
And it may not even be there now.
In the case of galaxies, they're almost certainly still there, but they would look different by now because they've had another 7 billion years to change, to evolve.
Stars may have burned out.
Correct. And as you go further back, if you look to, say, 13 billion light years away, now you're looking to within a billion years of the Big Bang. And then you ask, well, what would happen if you looked all the way to 14 billion light years away? Well, then in principle, you would see the light of the Big Bang.
From that moment.
It turns out we do see that light. It's called the cosmic microwave background, and that is what they detected this signal in the other day. It turns out it's not quite from that moment. It's from about 380,000 years after the Big
Bang.
That's
pretty darn close, Jeffrey.
It's pretty darn close. And the reason it goes back that far is because the universe was extraordinarily hot and full of light when the Big Bang occurred. And the early universe, it was still so hot that it would have been like being inside the sun, so that you can't see through the light. And it only became, the universe became transparent to light, so like stepping away from the sun and being able to see it in the distance, when it was about 380,000 years old. So that is the furthest back that we can see light from. What this new discovery is about is that even though the light is from 380,000 years ago, the light that we're seeing should still bear the signatures of when it was first created, going much, much further back to
very
Big Bang itself.
That's amazing. Now,
and that's what we're seeing, is these signatures left in there. But we cannot see back before that time, so there is no way for us to observe before the Big Bang. And in fact, there's an interesting philosophical question that comes out of relativity, which is that general relativity, special and general relativity, tell us that space and time are intertwined as what we call space-time. And the universe is, in a sense, space-time. And space-time is what has been expanding since the Big Bang. So you start to run into this question of, does such a thing as before the Big Bang even exist, since it was space and time both that were created?
That is such a paradox, isn't it?
It really is.
You'll probably go crazy trying to figure out what might have happened, because when we take this break, I want to come back and talk with you a little bit more, Jeffrey, about that. Assuming there was something before the Big Bang, let's see what it might be. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment. Jeffrey Bennett, his new work, What is Relativity? Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as I've been mentioning, Beyond Belief is our television program, and you can watch it free for 10 days. And you can also watch all the other programs that are out there. Just go to this website, beyondbelief.com, beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Jeffrey Bennett with us, his latest work, What is Relativity? Okay, Jeffrey, so if we know that the Big Bang occurred 14 billion years ago, I've got to ask the question that always seems to perplex me. what happened right before it, or what was right before it?
Well,
some say nothing. I can't comprehend nothing.
Nothing is a very strange concept, but so is something. Why is there something instead of nothing? And so I probably won't completely be able to answer your question of what happened before, because no one knows if there even was a before. But what I can tell you is the way to get at it is to understand what we mean by space-time.
Okay.
And I'll try to give you a little bit of a taste of that, even though it takes a little more effort to really get it to sink in. That's why I wrote a whole book on the topic.
It is mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is mind-boggling. But the idea is that space and time in our ordinary lives, we usually think of them as separate. If, you know, you have somebody driving past you, you would think that your clock and their clock would be the same, and that your measurements of distance and their measurements of distance would be the same. And at our ordinary speeds in daily life, they are the same to anything that we can notice with our own senses. But if you measure super carefully, or if you go at much higher speeds approaching the speed of light, you find, in fact, that the moving person measures time differently than you measure time, and they measure different distances differently than we measure distances. So distance we think of as space, right, the space between things, mm-hmm. and time. In daily life, they seem the same to everyone, but special relativity and general relativity tell us that different observers moving in different ways will actually measure them differently. But what we would all agree on, if we do the calculations, is what we call space-time. In other words, there's a combination of space and time that everyone will agree on. And a good way to think about it is that if you take two points, you know, like where you are and the local library, on a map, you can get between those points in many different ways. You can first go left and then go right, or vice versa. But the distance between them is the same no matter how you look at it, at least if you draw a straight line between them. And space-time, it's the same kind of idea. Different observers moving at different speeds will get different answers for the space part by itself and different answers for the time part by itself. But if they look at the space-time together, they would get the same answer. And so in that sense, what relativity is telling us is that the universe consists of this four-dimensional space-time, the original three dimensions of space that we usually think about, plus a fourth dimension, which is time. And in the expanding universe that we live in, it means that if you drew a four-dimensional graph, that graph is actually expanding. Now, of course, you can't draw in four dimensions. We can't even see in four dimensions.
Right.
But if you drew a two-dimensional analogy, like if you just made an XY graph, like a piece of graph paper on your iPhone or your iPad, and then you pinch and zoom so that the squares get bigger as you zoom out, that's exactly what's going on with the expanding universe. The universe has this four-dimensional grid of space and time, but it's expanding as time goes on. Now you go backwards in time and shrink it down, and eventually you're going to reach a point where you've shrunk it down to zero size, and that's the Big Bang.
And is it the shrinking and this expansion, is it constantly ongoing?
It has been ongoing since the Big Bang, yes. So the Big Bang was the beginning of the universe. It's the beginning of the expansion of the universe. This new discovery of inflation is that in the very, very earliest moment, a trillion, trillion, trillionth of a second after the initial expansion began, it suddenly expanded like crazy. It's like if you suddenly pinched and zoomed by a factor of, you know, many, many trillions, more than that. And then it settled into a more gradual expansion again after that. But the thing is that graph that's expanding is all of space and time. When you take it back to that zero size at the Big Bang, you've taken space and time back to their starting point. And so if you ask what came before that starting point, your graph doesn't even have any time on it before that.
Right. Which is, which is, again,
ask about before.
Difficult to comprehend.
The Stephen Hawking gave what I think is a really wonderful analogy. He said, asking about before the Big Bang is somewhat like asking what is north of the North Pole. And you can't go north from the North Pole because all directions from there are south.
That's right.
And in a similar sense, from the Big Bang, there's only one direction for time to expand outward. You don't have a way of going back before it, at least with our current understanding of time.
And when you say Big Bang, Jeffrey, are you also saying explosion? I'm trying to, I guess, correlate the two.
It's really not an explosion. In fact, the name Big Bang was actually coined by a scientist who at the time didn't believe that it had really happened, and he was making fun of the idea by calling it a Big Bang. And that gives this picture of an explosion, but it's really not. What it is we know the universe is expanding, and therefore, just logically, when you take it backwards, it was smaller in the past, and the Big Bang is just that point where it's as far back as you can go because you've shrunk it down to zero size.
Zero size. Okay. It's thinking of it as an explosion that has confused, I think, a lot of people.
It confuses people because when you visualize an explosion, you visualize something expanding into a pre-existing space. But space didn't exist before the Big Bang. Time didn't exist before the Big Bang. So space and time are being made as we go. So because the universe is expanding, there is more total amount of space in the universe right now than there was an hour ago when we started talking.
Let's take God out of the equation for a moment. How did it start? How did it get here? How was it created?
We don't know. And that is one of the questions that you know, that's where it really gets deep and philosophical and where you're at the frontiers of physics. One possible answer to that question is this multiverse, the idea that the universe, our universe, is just one little bubble.
One of many.
Of many, many. But in some sense, that's a very unsatisfactory answer. If I go back to Stephen Hawking again, he has a very famous book that he wrote a couple decades ago. And in it, he started with the story of the woman who he said, oh, this is all wrong. The earth is just sitting on the back of a giant turtle. And he said, well, what's underneath that turtle? And she goes, oh, it's sitting on top of another turtle. And he goes, you know, starts to say, what's that? And she goes, oh, don't be smart, young man. It's turtles all the way down, right?
Well, hey, that's the multiverse theory.
And that is, in a sense, the multiverse. But it's a very unsatisfactory answer. You can equally well say it was created on purpose by God at that point. And scientifically, that's just as valid of an answer as anything else.
Sure.
Science does not take God out of the equation at all.
It may be the easier answer.
It may be the easier answer, that's right. But the key point for science is that from science, we can't tell right now which, if either, of those answers is correct. So one of the goals in theoretical physics is to see if we ever come up with some calculations that would tell us something about how it or why it might have started. And if we do, can we then test them out? And so far, both those things are well beyond what we can say scientifically.
Jeffrey, what if it was always here, that there wasn't a beginning, the end, there wasn't an end, it was just always here?
That is another really interesting philosophical question that you get into with relativity, because relativity tells us that space and time are intertwined. So you can kind of think of the universe as this fabric of space-time. And that fabric has distortions in it, and those distortions are what we call gravity. So gravity is curvature of the space-time. And if you look at, say, yourself in space-time, if you were a four-dimensional being and you looked at George Norrie, you wouldn't just see yourself sitting in the studio right now. You would also see yourself all the way back through time to when you were born. So you are a permanent presence in space-time. It's what I call in the book your indelible mark on the universe. Every action you take is etched in space-time, And it's always there and always will be there. I think it's a very important thing for everyone to understand, because it's kind of like your what they told you was your permanent record back in elementary school, right? If you do a bad thing and you think you got away with it, well, maybe you did for now, but a four-dimensional being out there any time between now and the end of time can look, and if they look carefully, they'll see where you did that bad thing. It's on your permanent record. So I think everyone might be a little more careful about making sure they had a good permanent record if they understood this idea. But philosophically, when it's very easy in science and in relativity to say we would see you from your birth all the way to sitting in the studio right now if we could see you in four dimensions. But then you have to ask, does that mean we also see your future in four dimensions? And that, again, is a question that philosophers like to deal with. Kurt Vonnegut, if you've ever read any of his novels, loved dealing with that topic. It is kind of the central premise of his very well-known book, Slaughterhouse-Five, where Billy Pilgrim becomes unstuck in time. But scientifically, we don't really have an answer to that. It comes to this question of fate and the nature of space-time. Is the future already etched there in some sense? Or are we etching it as we go? Personally, I prefer to think we're etching it as we go, but it's a philosophical question.
Is there anything faster than the speed of light?
There is no possible way to travel faster than the speed of light through our ordinary space in our universe. And it's almost by definition, we might have a moment for me to tell you more about that later, but there may be ways to get around that limitation by, in a sense, leaving the universe and coming back in. And that is what, in the movie Star Wars, they call hyperspace. And in Star Trek, they do it by bending the universe so that distant places come closer together. They call that warp drive. So one of the ways I like to tell my students that we know you really can't go faster than the speed of light is because not even science fiction writers will try to do that. They know you can't, so they look for loopholes that get you around it by jumping out of the universe and jumping back in.
Gravity. You take gravity out of the equation, what happens?
Without gravity, there's no structure to space-time, because space-time is shaped by gravity. So you've got to have that gravity there in order to have space-time. And in fact, just to go back to this new discovery that we've talked about a little bit already, when you take the equations and go right back to this time of inflation, because you were so totally distorting gravity and space-time throughout the whole universe, it had to have left a signal by making what is called gravitational waves propagating through that early universe. And it's the signal from those gravitational waves, a prediction of Einstein that gravity should create these gravitational waves, that is what was detected, the signal from those.
What do you find, Jeffrey, as the most fascinating aspect of the universe?
Well, the most fascinating aspect of the universe is that it exists. You know, going back to that question of why is there something instead of nothing. Perhaps the second most fascinating thing about it is that we know it exists, because we, in that sense, represent the self-awareness of the universe. Without us, the universe could be doing all its stuff, but nobody would know about it.
Well, which also brings up an interesting take, too. You look at the universe, and you can marvel at it, with the other planets, suns, and solar systems that we're discovering. But then you have to add us into the equation, and it gets even stranger. Because, I mean, here we are. I mean, here I'm interviewing you. You're in Colorado. I'm in Los Angeles. What are we here for? How did this all come about? I mean, so we've got a question of the universe. How did it start, and why did it start? And then you got to add in all these other factors. It's absolutely strange.
It is. This is an idea that in science is called the anthropic principle. Why is it that the universe, if you imagine all the different possible laws of nature that there could have been, how did it come about that the laws of nature just happened to be in such a way that we ended up being here 14 billion years after it all started. You know, that seems a remarkable coincidence to have the perfect laws of nature. On the other hand, if we didn't have those perfect laws of nature, we wouldn't be here to talk about it, so we wouldn't know that we weren't here. So you get these really wild ideas. But this is where the multiverse comes in some of these ideas about how the universe fits into things. There were an infinite, or there are an infinite number of universes with different physical laws, and we just happen to be in the one that works for making it possible for us to be here. Now, that seems like a scientifically plausible idea, but have to remember there's no direct evidence of it. And personally, it's not my favorite idea in science, because I like to think there's more of a purpose to our existence than that would imply.
Do you add in the spiritual factor? You're a scientist.
I absolutely do add in the spiritual factor. For me, science is a very, very spiritual experience. Some of your listeners who have been watching Neil deGrasse Tyson's New Cosmos series will have heard him say the same words about science. Yes, science is spiritual. It tells us about our place in the universe and what the universe is really like. And unless we know that, we can't think about how we fit in. So it's very, very spiritual. It doesn't tell us exactly in what way it's spiritual. It doesn't tell us whether one particular religion is correct or not. That is up to you to choose how you want to believe. But certainly the science itself is a very spiritual idea.
Just amazing the way all of this is. The book, What is Relativity? It's available now?
It is. It is. Should be available in almost any bookstore you want to look in. Hopefully they'll have some copies in. You can also order it online or direct from the publisher. And if you go to my website, jeffreybennett.com, you can click on the cover and get more information and find links to buy it.
Do you find that children are fascinated with talk of the universe?
They absolutely are. And I should point out that when I wrote What is Relativity, I was aiming at, in particular, not just at grown-ups, but at middle school kids, where they're really starting to get that fascination. So if any of your listeners are concerned that they won't be able to understand the book, I actually had my drafts of it read by numerous middle school kids to make sure that they could understand it. So I think that means any grown-up who puts a little effort in will be able to understand it as well.
With everything that has been going on with science of late, CERN, the search for the God particle, where's the breakthrough going to come from, Jeffrey?
That's a good question. We're starting to see a little bit of evidence that sheds light on some of these theoretical ideas that people have been working on for decades that you've heard of by names like theory of everything and string theory and so on. But even though we're starting to get a little bit of evidence, my own sense is we're still fairly far off from the major breakthrough that will tie everything together, that will tie general relativity and quantum mechanics together. I hope it comes soon, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're still decades away from it.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Let's also talk about your earlier work on Beyond UFOs. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. We shall be right back.